Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Ross Kemp. Over the last 18 years, I've made some 90-odd documentaries, predominantly in hostile environments, from Afghanistan to Syria, from El Salvador to the Congo. And it's fair to say that during that time, I found myself in a few interesting situations. I've been shot at, tear gassed, had knives pulled on me, and spears thrown at me. But in all those years, what's impressed me the most is the resilience of the human spirit. Our ability, no matter where we're from, to overcome and make it through to the other side. So, in my new series, The Kemp Cast, I'll be talking to some incredible individuals who all have engaging stories to tell and have themselves overcome some extremely tough moments in their lives. Right now, we are living in unprecedented times, and we should be doing all we can together to get through this as safely as possible. I hope that if you subscribe to the Kemp Cast and hear how my guests overcame their toughest moments, it may help you overcome yours, whether you're going through one right now or you're faced with one in the future. Joining me today is ex-professional surfer, influencer and presenter Laura Crane. In 2018, she became a household name after appearing in ITV2's popular TV show, Love Island. I hope you enjoy listening. And please note that this episode was recorded just before the sad passing of Caroline Flack. Laura, you're pretty good at surfing, aren't you?
I'm not bad. My first national title I got when I was 14.
So what age group was it? Was that just...
That was
for 14-year-olds or for...
Yeah, no, under 14s.
And
then the following year, I was 15.
Sorry, you got the under 14s when you were 14. You must have got that when you were 13.
Sorry, yeah, 13.
Yeah,
no, actually, I got the under 14s when I was 12.
All right.
And then I got on the following year, or however many years after,
yeah,
I won the under 14s, under 16s and Women's Open.
All right.
It's such a long time ago now.
But you were open champion. You have been
yeah.
the best female surfer in the United Kingdom.
Yeah. I carried on with those titles until I moved to France and started doing the European tour. And I didn't compete in the UK anymore. So Billabong sponsored me when I was 12.
What kind of pressure is that when you're 12?
It was my dream. I was like a nightmare at
school. Hang
on,
you're 12. You're 12.
Yeah, but I think I'd always done loads of sports growing up. I did motocross, horse riding, gymnastics, like swimming. I ran competitively, so I'd done literally all of them. But surfing was the one that kind of I felt like I had an escape from. I was really struggled at school. I wasn't very academic. So it was kind of like my outlet to just, yeah.
So you're born in Bristol, right?
Yeah.
It's got some water, but not necessarily a lot of surf.
Yeah, no.
Doesn't the Severn once a year have this kind of tidal wave that comes down and people actually do surf?
Sick after it, yeah. But
have you done it?
No, I've never done it, but I've had mates.
Well, when you say sick, you mean you get what, Vial's disease or something?
Oh, you just get like ill, like you're puking for like the next 2 days if you just drink something like that.
We'll come on to actually the environment, because I'm pretty sure that you've travelled to enough seas now to notice just how much damage we've done to our oceans. But so there you are, you're UK champion, open UK champion. Did you encounter, I mean, all these people that have been there for so many years, all of a sudden this young kid comes along. Do you know what I mean? She's only just started a couple of years ago, and now she's open champion. How were you received?
At the start, like definitely at the start of my surfing career, really well. Everyone was like, oh, there's like this new girl that's like coming through and like really quickly improving. It was great. And then I think I was one of the first girls to ever get sponsored by a big brand. So Billabong sponsored me pretty soon on. And then as I started traveling and kind of like making money from surfing, there was definitely a lot of like jealousy and everyone was a little bit more hostile. And I
how did that manifest itself?
I think because I was also modeling for Billabong, so I was doing all their kids range, like modeling their clothes and stuff, which at that point was like such fun. We'd literally just like rip around on mopeds and like be traveling around and just having photos.
How old?
12, 13.
That's a lot happening for 12/13. I mean, they are really, really kind of very important years in terms of particularly females' development. They're pretty important for a male as well, but it sort of happens a bit later generally for boys, as they say. But so there you are, developing really from a girl into a woman, as it were, and you're traveling around on scooters, motorcycles, surfboards, going to exotic locations and having your photograph taken. I mean, keeping your feet on the ground, literally keeping your feet on the ground.
Yeah, trying to when possible. I don't know, I think it literally been my dream since I first got a surfboard at the age of 9. I knew that was all I wanted. Like, I wanted to just do that. And like I said, I hated school and it kind of just...
Yeah, I just want to do that, but that didn't happen for me.
I mean, I trained a lot. I trained hard and I think my dad was a professional athlete and I...
So what did your dad do?
He was a professional runner.
Oh, right.
So he ran 1,500 metres, yeah. So I'd always had that mentality of if you're going to succeed in something, like it's your all, you know, of a sport. And dad was never pushy. Mum, they were like, you know, you're like good at your sports and that's great. They always made sure that I was still like doing school bits and stuff like that. But
were they worried about you academically? You said you struggled.
As in, I struggled as in I wasn't the brightest in the class. And for me, I'm so competitive. That if I'm not great at something or like the best, it
are you
was
a bit
like,
of
I don't 100%
to have had a few of those through the doors. If you're not going to, if you can't give this thing 100%, I'm not going to do it. I'll cut away from that and I'll go and do something else where I can be very successful at it and give it my all. Yeah.
Well, mine was I enjoyed it so much that I wanted to be the best at something that I really enjoyed. You know.
What did the kids at school think?
It was really weird at school. Because I was already traveling so much so young that we had tutors that traveled with us when we were traveling with Billabong. So they'd kind of like...
What, Billabong sponsored t-shirts for you?
Not like sponsored t-shirts, but we'd like take work with us. And like we'd have to do like hours of work while we were away. Like
who was tutoring you?
So like our team managers would make sure that it was all being done. But because they're like your parents. You travel with them for like 6 months of the year. So they're literally like your parents and your sisters, like the girls
and
you travel
because
with.
Your father, as you say, came from a sporting background. He was quite happy and quite sure that you'd be safe in that kind of environment.
Yeah, they'd met Billabong had been around me since I was like 12 years old. So they have to put in, you know, they have to put in trust. And Billabong also on the other side, they had to kind of instill that into mum and dad and make sure that they knew like, yeah, we are taking your daughter like to the other side of the world and she's going to be surfing waves and she's going to be doing like a lot of dangerous things. But, you know, I think I have so much respect for my parents because I honestly don't know if I'd be able to do that when I have kids. But for them to just be like, okay, like we've got to let her go. This is like what she, you know, we can't stop her.
I can understand
this.
letting them go when you're about 16. It's a big gap between 12 and 16.
To be fair, from 12 to 13, I wasn't like full-time traveling. I was backwards and forwards, like everything was a bit more in Europe. And then we'd have like two or three big trips to Hawaii and Australia every
year.
So
you've been to Hawaii?
Yeah.
That's really annoying me. Where are the best waves?
For me, like my favorite place to surf is Portugal or Mexico. Sick.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's just like quiet. I think it's the vibe of everything. Like the people are super chill.
Whereabouts in Mexico?
So Huatulco.
Don't know.
So it's kind of, you'd never go there unless you surfed. It's like that kind of vibe.
I got lost. I was open water once for 9 hours in the Baja Peninsula. I don't tell many people.
Yeah,
this
what? It's that Baja de la Cruz. Yeah, it's that same.
So you find
the
bottom of
the pass. It's right there.
And then we got on a yacht like you do. I won't tell you how rich this family are, but they're one of the richest families on the planet. And they wanted to go for open water spearfishing.
Yeah.
Well, the closest I got to water was going over Albert or Chelsea Bridge, right? And in those days, I used to smoke Marlboro Lights, which I hate to this day, the idea of the fact that I ever smoked. I didn't smoke all the time, but I did. So the idea of like emptying my lungs and trying to go down 1 meter was high, and they were going down like 12 meters and then trying to shoot very, very big fish. Anyway, I said to them, I'm going to try and fin back to the boat. I tried to swim 9 nautical miles against an outgoing tide, right? There's no one about. They've got special permission to be in this area. The Baja, the actual length of Baja, the actual peninsula that goes inland, is the length of Britain.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah, I know.
We're like, so I'm like, we're in Middlesbrough, right? And I'm trying to get to London, literally. No, I'm not. I'm trying to do 8 miles against the tide. I told the bloke on the boat, on the rib, that I would be, if you couldn't see me, I'd be the beyond the boat, but look for me on the way back. But I should have thought, I was so sure that I'd make it back. I can hear them, it's now gone dark, right? I've still got my weight belt on, right? I'm so dehydrated, I'm
loose. You still kept the weight belt on? Nice.
Really good. Clever? Yeah. Really clever, yeah. I've still got my spear gun.
Oh, why not? Well, you never know, you might
need really handy.
Sharks.
Well, no, but sailfish came up past me, and then I've got 2 seals swimming next to me. Now, we know what, who likes to eat seals? Sharks. Great white sharks, yeah, right? Obviously. That place is full of white sharks because it's full of seals. And who's the fattest seal in the ocean? Kempy. Do you know what? They eventually found me. I was whistling. I was like, going, bzzz, bzzz. You know, you listen to like props underwater, you that bzzz.
Yeah.
I'm whistling, I'm screaming, I'm shouting. When the two guys had got back to the boat, right, my wife, my then wife, was on the boat, right? So they washed off, they hung up the fish they'd caught. They went downstairs. They all had a kip. They all come back up for dinner, right? Bear in mind, I was gone like 7-8 hours, right? Right? They all sit down for dinner, right? And they're like going, oh, Ross and his wife have had an argument. So obviously he's staying in his cabin. So they only get to the main course before they go. So Ross not eating then. I thought Ross was out with you. I thought he was still out in the boat.
Oh, my God.
No, he found me. Obviously, they found me. Otherwise, I would still I'd be shark food. Anyway, that was my boring story for
today. So you're great, good swimmer then?
I've got a lot of buoyancy. Let's put it that way.
Not with that weight belt on.
Keeping the weight belt on. What was that about? Weirdo. Real weird. But anyway, so Mexico is best for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, tell me on your travels around the world, and I've traveled a little bit as well. You know, I've just noticed in the 25 years that, you know, I was making docs, I have been making docs, is that just the filth in our oceans. I mean, I did a film about piracy. So, you know, we're in the Bight of Benin, we went up to Malacca Straits. The amount of plastic in the oceans is just shocking, yeah, isn't it? Do you not think that all those big companies, and I just want to aim at Billabong, but all those big surf companies and all those kind of marine type sports companies, they should be doing something a bit more?
It's like, it's honestly been a battle.
We should all be doing a bit more.
Yeah, no, for sure. I lived in Bali for 2.5 years. I moved back in 2021. So yeah, 4 years ago. And it's been a massive issue for years. Obviously they hide it so well for such, well, they hid it for so long for, you know, just to kind of make Bali look beautiful and make sure people were coming in and doing tourism and, you know, kind of building the country up, which now it's booming and like tourism is amazing and they're really thriving. But then the ocean plastic, you can't hide from anymore. You can't not see it. I was literally there 2 weeks ago and every single time I go back, you see it more and more and more. And on the surface of everything, they're hiding it, you know, in like these nice bougie new restaurants, you don't see anything. And if you go out to the back of it, they, you know, there's
plastic
everywhere, but they're in the front being like, oh, but we use bamboo straws, you know? So there's like a real like miscommunication between like the tourism and then the actual like local people, because
but also they're going to go for the cheapest option. Which, well, yeah, is for sure. Plastic, right?
But it will always be the cheapest option for them right now. But when I went into a few schools when I lived there and we kind of tried to, you know, teach them at the start, because it's a generation thing. You know, if you're going in and telling parents to go and do this, they're like, well, we've been doing this for years, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, but and
if
also, you go who tell are you kids, to tell me?
Yeah. So we went in and we were kind of, you know, trying to just give them just more information, because I feel like that's something that they lack so much. Mm. And there has been a massive difference, you know, like the governments there have been putting more recycling and they are doing more, but it's the rubbish coming in from elsewhere, you know. They're obviously creating a lot, but it's all coming in from like so many different places. And
but would you say that in the time, and you've been doing this for some years now, you know, traveling around the world, spending a lot of time in oceans, in different oceans, that you've seen an increase, personal increase?
Massively. Even last Christmas, or this Christmas just gone, Mum and I were walking at the beach in Devon, and it was really sad, actually. There was two little girls on the beach just walking with their mum with a little bucket, and they were, like, picking bits up. And when me and Mum walk on the beach with the dog, we always pick bits of litter up and just, you know, bits you can see, like big bits. And these two young girls were, like, kind of, like, sieving through the sand. So I, like, walked over and I was, oh, we, like, thought they were looking for shells. And they were sieving through and getting all the tiny little, they're called nurdles, like the little mini, like tiny plastics. And they were making, like, sandcastles and, like, bits like that, and they were playing around. And I said to Mum, I was like, because we used to go there every weekend as kids and make sandcastles there, and it was crazy. It was, like, they were making sandcastles, and they were kind of, like, dotted with, like, little, like, plastic bits. And I said to my mum, like, you never used to visually see it, you know? Like, it's there, it's everywhere. Like, you literally look through the sand and not see, like, a patch with, like, all these little, like, dots in. So even, like, on my home beach in the UK, which is meant to be, like, blue flag beach and, like, really clean and, like, fantastic, even there, you know, like, you can't get away from it now. Like, the fish are eating it, the birds are eating it. Like, they're dying from these things, and it's on our doorstep. Like, there is no hiding from it now.
Mm. But do you think there's enough being done about it?
No. But, you know, I was, like, coming out of, I did Love Island, and I came out of there, and you get offered all of these crazy clothing deal brands, and it's a lot of fast fashion, which I point blank have always said no to, and I cannot, just because of what I believe in and my environmental beliefs. I'd be a massive hypocrite to take the money.
Did you turn down a lot of cash
though? Oh yeah, that was the hardest thing, was like,
well, if you're
something
honest
that
about
you
that,
really
yeah.
believe in, like, really, like, my hand on my heart, like, it really, like, yeah, upsets yeah. me, like, a lot, you know, this is like, mm-hmm. the ocean gave me everything I have, kind of thing.
Go back to Love Island, though. So you the first time you were offered it, you turned it down, right?
Yeah.
Why'd you turn it down?
I think I'd gone through a few, like, mental health kind of struggles when I finished competing and, like, during. Mm-hmm. And then I moved back to Portugal and just had, like, a 2 years of, like, regrouping, like, figuring out, like, next move, whether I was going to either go back to competing or whatever I was going to do next. I kind of sat there and chatted to my manager that first year, and I was like, no, maybe this year I go back to competing, or maybe I just don't want to do, like, maybe I just want to, like, make a surf school and just teach lessons at the beach.
That is a nice option. Can I?
Oh yeah, no, it's still there. Don't worry.
Can I come?
Yeah, definitely.
I've always wanted to learn
to
surf.
Yeah.
But let's go back. So you said no first time because why?
I just didn't think I was ready. Yeah. And I knew it was going to be a massive thing. And I'd always said to myself, if I was ever going to go on such, like, a big platform, I needed to know.
It's one of the biggest reality shows, particularly for your age group, isn't it?
Yeah. I needed to know exactly who Laura Crane was. I knew I wasn't like those other girls, and I wasn't, like, glam and, like, cute and, like, doing all those, like, girly bits.
But you're a model. You're a good looking lady.
But I was always, like, an athletic model. Like,
yeah,
I was,
sure.
You know, so for me, it was making sure that no matter what anybody said about me when I came out or when I was in there, that I was like, you know what, I don't care, because, like, this is me and I'm proud of me. And I've gone on there to be something different.
So the first time you said no because of that, then what made you to say yes the second time?
I just, in Portugal, like, surfing every day. And I think because I wasn't really doing much in that year, and I'd been, like, seeing other people kind of, like, go into that show and, like, come out and just all do kind of, like, very similar things, which is fab. Like, some people have got, like, amazing careers out of it and they've done so well. But I think I really struggled in seeing that there was no one on there for kind of, like, 15-year-old Laura to, like, when I was going through, like, all my changes and stuff. And, you know, I was, like, a massive tomboy. There was no one really for, like, 15-year-old Laura to look up to in that show that I felt. So I just, I kind of wanted to go in and just be like, hey, like, you can have broad shoulders, like, you can be in the pool all day, like, you don't have to, like, brush your hair, like, and do all the curling bits and, like, makeup.
I've ruled that out of my life.
You know? Well, yeah, no, you're fine. You got it easy.
Done about that.
So, yeah, no, it was just I just wanted to go in there and kind of be something different and, inspire girls that got a bit confused.
And
did you
do that, do you think?
Yeah, I had, honestly, like, coming out of there, so many messages from girls being like,
how many?
Like thousands. And even now, you know, like, they see a surf video and they're like, wow, it's so nice that, you know, just to see a girl, like, go out and, like, do their thing and be, like, strong and, like, powerful and, you know, not cow down in, like, a male dominated sport. And those
is it a male, how male dominated is it?
Crazy.
Like, so it's all about blokes,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But also, I mean, could not a woman be as good as a bloke at that sport? I mean, it's one of the things where you possibly could do because it's your ability to hit the right way, surely.
I think a lot of the time it comes down to like power, as in like physical strength, which is what makes, because surfing is about, the criteria of like a wave is to surf a wave with speed, power and flow and like technicality. So the more power you have in like your body, the faster you go. So usually guys will be a more powerful surfer, but that's not to say that, you know, these girls are like pushing all the boundaries. Like they're surfing waves that are like,
how tall?
I think Maya last year did like, I think she did like 80 feet.
Oh, get out of here.
Yeah.
80 feet.
And dude, this chick is like beautiful. And she like walks down the beach, puts on her vest, and she's like out there with,
where's
with
she
all
from?
The boys. She's from Brazil.
Right. 80 feet.
Mm-hmm.
These are kind of waves that people get towed up
yeah.
to.
Yeah.
And whereabouts are the 80-foot waves?
This one was in Nazaré, so it's like an hour and an
that's Mexico,
hour and a half.
Is it? Is it Mexico?
No, in Portugal.
Nazaré, I didn't even know where that is.
Yeah, so
80-foot waves in Portugal.
Yeah, between Porto and Lisbon on that like coast. Yeah, so chicks are doing it like they're going for it.
Is the sponsorship different? So, i.e., you know, for instance, in tennis, we do know that, you know, and in many other sports, you know, where women compete in different areas, that the sponsorship is less. If you're a man,
yeah,
I think Federer earns more money than a Williams, even though they're probably quite both well off. They're not worrying about
no, they're chill,
about
they're
whether
fine.
paying for the holiday next year.
When I first started surfing, girls were doing things to look like boys. We were wearing long board shorts, we were wearing like long t-shirts, and we were trying to be like the boys. Mm-hmm. And then actually it was my generation of surfing that Instagram came in when we were 15, and our sponsor said, okay, girls, because you model for the brand and you're like marketable, but you also compete and you're professional athletes, you have two sides of your contract. So you're, you know,
one is you being an athlete and the other one is you being a model.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But we didn't give, like, the modeling bit was kind of, you know, part and parcel. We did it to keep Billabong happy, but we were athletes. Like, that was like what we grew up doing and loving. And then Instagram kind of came in and we started wearing like shorter shorts and like more bikinis. And then all of a sudden we were like, you know what? We sunbathe on the beach in a bikini. So why don't we just surf in our bikinis? And
mainly because it's freaking cold if you're trying to do that.
Oh,
in,
yeah, but I wasn't
Newquay.
Living here. and then there was a massive shift because all of a sudden we had like the girls that were competing against us that maybe weren't so marketable and like weren't doing the modeling and like weren't so like putting themselves out there kind of thing. We're getting really jealous because we were getting bigger sponsorship deals and kind of things
money,
like that.
Even though they might be better surfers, yeah?
And then it kind of crossed into the competitive and into the competitive side, being like, oh, that judge only gave you that because you're cute and like you're hot and they fancy you. So it all kind of like merged into
Did it get nasty?
Like, oh, surfing got bitchy. Imagine, you're all like traveling together.
I want to hear it.
All right, so I traveled with five girls, my Billabong team. It was me, an American girl, a Hawaiian, and two Australians. We were like sisters. We had like all the same clothing, the same brand. So we'd literally pack up, leave Hawaii, and it would all go into like a suitcase, just chucked in. We called it the floor drobe, because everywhere we'd arrive, we'd literally just like
floor drobe
it. Yeah. But we'd still manage to have arguments about like one piece of clothing. They're like, that was mine. I'm like, we've all got the same shit. Like, chill. I wouldn't say it never got nasty because you're family. You travel together the whole time.
I'll tell you what, it gets nasty with my family occasionally.
There was, you know, the hardest thing was, is your sisters, you're traveling, you're like, all your bits that you're going through, you're growing up, you're like in your, you know, fundamental years of like changes. The hardest thing I think was, they're your best mates and they're your sisters, but they're also your competitors.
Competitors, yes. So that's an odd one, isn't it?
Yeah, that was really tough. So you're training together every single day in the sea, out of the water, and then you're eating dinner, you're like doing all the things, you're hanging out
that's
as like
really
mates,
close,
you're traveling together. Literally for 9 months of the year, we traveled on tour together. And yeah, I don't know how we're still mates now.
Are you still mates now?
Yeah.
So you've been through all that, but you said you talked about, you know, we have on this podcast, we talk about toughest moments. And I know you're 25, but you have had a few, haven't you? What was the toughest?
I think kind of making the decision whether to stay in my sport and, you know, potentially go back into the mental kind of like areas that I was in that I really struggled, or just to say, you know what, I'm just going to do something new and I'm going to put everything into it and I'm going to do something completely new. I think that for a professional athlete that's, you know, never really gone to like college or uni or, you know, it's all I'd ever known.
You can still do that now.
Yeah. Oh God, I'm good on it. But
but then what I'm saying is, where are you? You know, you see your mental health.
Mm.
I mean, give me an example of where you were.
So obviously, like I said, I was a model, but I was also a professional athlete. Mm. So I was making money from modeling, but also, you know, the thing that I lived for was my sport. Mm. And trying to, you know, at the age of 16, trying to balance those two body types that I thought I was meant to have. So on one side of the spectrum, I thought I was meant to be this like skinny model because I was with Models One in London as well at the time. So I was shooting like for other brands and stuff. And then on the other side of it, I had to be as strong as possible because I was a professional surfer and I was, you know, mm-hmm. surfing these waves and doing all these things. So I think that balance of like not really knowing like how I or who I was meant to be, or like was I meant to be what Billabong wanted me to be as like an athlete, or did they want me to be more a model? And then Instagram,
or were you being
came
pulled
in,
by those all, two different forces?
Yeah, for sure. And then
when I say that, I mean not just, sorry, were you being pulled by those different forces? And I don't necessarily mean because you wanted to be good at one or be good at the other. Were there actual people saying you've got to look like this and you've got to behave like that? Yeah. So at a very kind of youngish age, you've got dominant factors in your life pulling you north and south.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is when it all kind of, like I said, with like the Instagram and social media, when that kind of all came in, they used to use their athletes for all the modeling stuff and all like their kind of
endorsement.
Yeah, well, no, like the photo shoots for like the catalog and all that kind of stuff. Mm. And like the billboards was all athletes and girls on surfboards. And then it kind of switched as kind of social media came in and they wanted to perceive this like new kind of surf girl, because before every like surf girls, if you look at surf girls in like, I don't know, mid 90s, they're like, you know, blokes. Yeah. Like they're big girls, and they're like, you know, trying to look like the guys. They wanted to be like men, they wanted to prove themselves to the boys. And then it kind of had that shift, and then I think when it had that shift, we were all a bit like, oh my God, okay, so now they're using skinny models to do the job we used to do.
And that had an effect on you mentally?
Oh, massive. All five of us. And you know, the craziest thing was, because we were sisters but competitors, I had really bad bulimia. One of the other girls had, like, basically didn't eat. And the other two had, like, really suicidal thoughts, was depressed. And we never spoke about it until about a year ago. Just
so even
because
you were
it
there,
was weakness, you know?
Could proceed. To talk about, let's talk about bulimia. Do you know what? We're looking this up just now. It looks like twice as many people over the last 7 years have ended up in hospital with eating disorders.
Yeah.
Would you say that's something that you find shocking, or do you just
think
that's the way things are going? Do you think social media plays a part in
massively,
that?
Massively. You're basically flicking through and just comparing the whole time. And even now, you know, I've had my struggles and I see myself comparing myself to other people. I'm like, Laura, why? Like,
why does social media, and when we're using it here now, I'm hopefully using it to be entertaining and informing, why does it create such competition in terms of body shape? Because the thinner you are, the more attractive you are, the more successful you are. Is that it?
I don't know. I think it all goes in trends, doesn't it? You had the Kardashians, and they were all about having a big bum and a small waist and big boobs, which realistically is all an unattainable goal unless you've had surgery and like you've got a trainer that trains you like three times a week and does it like, you know, to fit your body type. People can't afford these kinds of things, you know? Yeah.
But why does the body shape on social media create so many issues for so many young people? Who's influencing it? Is it fashion, or is it actually the people on social media?
No, it's the influencers. The influencers are there photoshopping half the time.
Yeah.
Everything is now photoshopped on Instagram. So you're using this app and it takes you, what, 10 minutes at home, however long it takes you to photoshop something. And then you've got these young, impressionable girls that are sat at home being like, oh my God, how am I meant to look like that? You can't.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
What would you say if someone's listening to this now and they're bulimic? What would you say?
To get help. Straight away. I think as soon as I told my parents, and well, they actually found out, but as soon as they knew, you know, there's such easy, simple ways to get better. And it's not easy. It's not overnight. And it's, you keep working and you fail once, you fail twice.
What you're saying is that like for many things, for many issues, whether it be any addiction, mm-hmm. really is the first step and the hardest step is to start talking about it.
For sure. 100%. And even, you know, I've relapsed and I've had, you know, times when it's come back and it's embarrassing, especially for somebody like me who's like quite competitive with themselves. It feels like failure when you relapse. But the most important thing is when you relapse is to speak about it again and not just be like, oh, because it's really easy, I think, with these kinds of things to speak in past tense and kind of say, I used to have bulimia. I used to struggle with mental health, to mentally make you feel like you're better, but actually you're just covering it up again. So I think the most important times are when you first kind of address it and you've spoken about it once is to, when you do relapse, because it, you know, I personally think bulimia for me is something that in a way I will always carry with me. The thoughts. The reason that I, like, that my bulimia got so bad was because it was a control thing. I was living such a transient life. I was kind of, one day I was in Hawaii, next day I was flying to Oz. Then
which to most people listening to this sounds absolutely idyllic, but actually it is
especially for like a kid when you're that age, not even knowing where you're going to be tomorrow night, where you're going to sleep, what country you're gonna,
well, they knew.
They knew like 2 days before, but then they weren't sure like what flight we were going to be on, all those kinds of things. So I think the bulimia is like a control thing. When your life is so kind of everywhere and like
chaotic,
stressful,
this was something this thing that you could control.
Eat, purge, like, so you eat like a lot and then you like vomit and you kind of have this, it's really weird, but you have this sense of like, okay, I'm in control of just this one thing. So everything else can seem so kind of out of control and crazy, but you have control over this one small tiny part of your life and it makes you feel, but then it starts to control everything else because you then start not wanting to eat in certain places and you know that you've got to make sure that you find a toilet to go to straight after you've eaten, and it very, very quickly overtakes kind of anything else.
So you say it was something that you could control yourself in a sea of chaos. This was the one thing that you had control of. And how did you get over it? Or you say you never get totally over anything, I guess.
I'm really close to my family, even though I'd obviously traveled for a long time. They'd, you know, we are a really close family. I would always call and we chat. I was living in Bali at the time when I was at my illest, when it got quite dangerous. And Dad literally called me. He was like, "You're on the next flight home. Otherwise, I'm coming there. I'm coming to get you." And that was it. I literally like pack my bags from Bali. And I think it was that flight home literally was the worst.
Was it? Tell me.
Just sitting there and being like, wow, I actually have to confront this for the first time in my life.
I'm going to have to talk about this.
Yeah, to my mum and my dad. I think that was like really hard for me.
How old?
I was 21. So I'd had it from 16 to 21. And
So you've been doing that for 5 years?
Yeah. And like puking like 6 times a day. Like,
it's also going to hurt your insides, isn't it?
Yeah, it'll burn you.
Oh,
the like effects it had on the body. I didn't have a period for like 3.5 years. And you know, this thing that scared me most was when I was just leaving Bali. I was so stressed that I literally just didn't eat for like almost a week.
What?
Yeah. And I've done 3 days. Yeah.
I did 3 days without food once. And honestly.
And training. I was still surfing.
No, man. Like, I wasn't training. I was just trying. Yeah. It was in a very hot climate and there was just no food. But shit. Sorry. Yeah.
Crazy.
Week without food. And also because you're surrounded by it as well. I mean, the reason I didn't eat food was because there was no food.
Yeah. But yeah, that flight home, and I was like, wow, I'm actually going to have to sit down with my parents and be like, yeah, I've hidden this for you for 5 years. I just didn't want them to feel like by them letting me go and like live my dream and do the thing that I love, that they'd kind of failed and that they'd made a mistake. Because I knew that's how they'd, you know, how they'd feel. Like they'd blame it on themselves.
That's how parents always feel.
Yeah. So that was really, really hard. And I think, you know, the moment it was seeing my dad.
Hopefully that's how parents should feel. Yeah.
Seeing my dad sat on the end of my bed and literally say to me, like crying. And like my dad, like, he's not a big crier. Like,
no, he's
like
a professional athlete,
dad,
like, right?
Yeah,
don't
yeah.
do tears.
And like, not much emotion between like me and my dad. Like, he's my like idol. But seeing him sat there and crying, and he was like, I'm not letting you do this. You know, like he told me, he was like, it's not fair on like us. And also I will not let you sit there and like just kill yourself. Like it's selfish. Mm. And I was like, okay, yeah. Because I thought this was all about me. And the moment that I realized it was like affecting other people, and it kind of took all the pressure like off me a little bit in a weird way. And
of course,
I was like,
because you're actually coming clean, aren't you?
Well, yeah. And then so I was like, yeah, I'm going to do this for them, because I had such little self-worth at that moment. I was like,
so
I
there you
care.
Are. But you've been a national champion, you're competing European, you're, you know, the billabong lady, and you've got no self-esteem.
Yeah. Zero on the floor, like literally nothing.
Which for most people, including myself, sounds ridiculous.
Oh, me too. Even now, bonkers. Like when I look back, I'm like, how? Like, how did
Bill
you get
bonkers,
there? Yeah, exactly.
Called, yeah?
But yeah, then slowly, I mean, I spent a long time, like read like a million self-help books and really just rebuilt my personality, because I had nothing. I was literally like this walking eating disorder. I had, there was no aspect of like Laura anymore, like this fun bubbly girl that I was when I was, you know, growing up and doing these things. It just kind of disappeared. And my mum, she said to me, she was like, it was so sad, like you didn't laugh for ages, and it was really weird to like have you at home. And like, because usually when I'd go home, I'd like kind of fake it and be like, oh yeah, I'm fine.
Yeah, sure.
And then yeah, literally just rebuilding my personality like back and kind of molding myself into how I wanted to be as a person. And it sounds really weird, but I knew this like Mexican kid from like growing up, and he had this kind of personality where he'd walk into any room and he could just light it up. And I was like, I want to be like that. And I remember speaking to my therapist, and she said, you have the capability to do that. This is your life. You can be who you want to be. If you want to be like the person that, you know, can light up a room, but also by doing that, you have to also make sure that you're not doing it for other people. Because I think that was always a really easy thing for me to do, was like kind of fake it and like be like the life of the party, really, really happy to like kind of hide how I was actually feeling. But yeah, it was, the recovery was one of the hardest things in my life, was having bulimia. But I'm so grateful for the journey that I had from it.
Do you get a lot of people on social media talking about it to you who have got it, or are you helping people in a way? I'm just talking about it now. You're helping people.
No, definitely. I have, especially when I do things like this where I speak about it so openly. And I, you know, my thing is, I don't want it, it shouldn't be an embarrassing thing. No. You know, I don't think there was a time when I remember sitting at home being like, this is like the worst thing. I can't believe anyone's ever going to find out about it. And it was actually the week
after.
Well,
it's also not like a new condition.
Yeah,
it's been around. Well, yeah, for
ever.
Longer.
Like,
yeah.
And I think the less stigma like around it, the easier it is to get better, the easier it is to talk about it and things like that. And
totally.
I'm not embarrassed about it anymore. And if I was to relapse tomorrow or next week or in, you know, 10 years, I hope by then it's a completely normal thing to speak about and be able to just go and like chat to your mate and be like,
But so we're talking about bulimia, but also you nearly died, didn't you?
Yeah. All those years of surfing and bloody sepsis got me.
Yeah. Begins with an S.
Yeah.
Surfing sepsis.
It's not the same, sadly.
No, it's not. No. Well, let's just get people out there going to know what it is, but it's blood poisoning, isn't it? Extreme blood poisoning.
Yeah.
Go on.
So it was literally about 4 months after I'd come out of Love Island. I was living in Portugal at the time I went into Love Island, so I actually moved in with my manager. I lived with her for 3 months and I was away from the ocean. I was kind of going out and like drinking with like mates. And then I was also working like every single day.
Doing?
And just kind of like modern. The post Love Island bits, like events or whatever. And I still to this day think that it was pure just like running myself into the ground, a new change of life. I really wasn't enjoying being in London. I'd never lived in the UK since I was literally like 15. So it was like this whole new thing. And I was like, is this really what I want to do? Like, do I really want to be here? And I think I was kind of just running away from it and just making myself so busy.
But you were over your bulimia at this point.
Yeah. No, that was gone. But just making myself so busy and like really ran myself down. I got quite ill. Mum called me and she said, are you okay? You've not like really messaged me back much. I'm just checking you're okay. I was like, yeah, I'm fine. Just got a bit of a cold. Like, I'm just going to chill. And I was like, I'm coming on my period. Like, probably just feeling like a bit low. And she was like, look, I'm going to come to London. I'm going to drive to London tomorrow. We're going to go shopping for the day. Have a nice day. And like, just want to spend some time with you. I was like, yeah. Like, sounds great. So she drove up to London and I felt horrendous that morning. Like, really, really bad. And I was like, this is a bit weird. So I called mum and I was like, actually, maybe you might need to take me to the hospital. And for me to say that, I would like never. Like, I would walk around with like broken fingers and like everything for like weeks. And I wouldn't even like flinch at it. And she was like, oh, okay, a bit rogue, but fine, we'll go. And I kind of thought I'll get some like antibiotics. I'll be out in like an hour. So they check your temperature and they check your heart rate. And my heart rate was literally through the roof. And I have like a really low resting heart rate anyway. And they said to my mum, they're like, okay, she's septic. And they literally pulled me straight in. And I didn't really know what that was. I was quite delirious at the time and I didn't really figure out what was going on. And next thing
but
I knew...
You've got to be poisoned by something or something inside you, right?
So mine was... The scariest thing and the reason why it got so dangerous was because it took them 8 days to figure out where the infection was coming from. So it starts from an infection within your body somewhere. It can either be from a cut, from like external, or
your body
be
starts poisoning
from
itself.
From inside, So at first, because I had like pains in my stomach, they thought it was maybe a kidney infection. Then they thought it was an appendix. But for each of those things, they have to try the antibiotics.
Oh, really?
And if it doesn't work in 24 hours, they've got to figure out what it is and where it's coming from. So for 8 days in there, I was just getting more and more and more and more infected.
So your mum's with you?
Mum's in hospital every day. And I'd never slept in a hospital before in my life. I'd like never been ill at all with like any kind of like body like making myself. And I think that was the weirdest thing. I would like never saw myself as that person in the hospital. I was like, I'm fit, I'm healthy. Like that would never happen to me. And then day 9, my blood infection level was like 2.
It was getting worse.
Yeah,
right?
It was like high 200s. And they basically had said to my mum, which she hadn't told me, was it gets to a certain level where the clean blood basically goes to all of your organs, so into your chest, so your limbs at some point, which is why a lot of people have like the amputations and things like that. And I literally looked at her and I said, mum, I've got no kids. I've had, for a 24-year-old, I've had like, as far as they go, like a pretty sick life. The thought of me living with no limbs, that's not a life like for me, you know, like I wouldn't be able to make that decision. Cause they kind of said, you know, it gets to that point where you have to, you lose the limbs, you amputate, or you die. Yeah. And I was like, or you risk it and you just carry on you just hope that you get better before it all kind of like packs in. And I said to mum, there would never be a moment where I'd be like, yeah, okay, like amputate. I think for me mentally doing like what I've done growing up and as active as I am, I don't think I could have made that decision.
Well, sadly, some people don't have that decision to be able to make. So you're very awfully lucky.
For sure. And, you know, how quickly they got, honestly, the NHS were incredible. Mm. Like, there was days where I felt so, so low and, like, I could was never going to get better. And I remember, like, I had to tell mum, like, just go, have a walk. Like, you go and, like, have some time. And
but this still wasn't, they still hadn't worked
they
out.
They still hadn't figured out where it was coming from.
But your compass, you were able to talk, you were able to communicate.
Yeah. No. I was quite like alert because I was on so many like painkillers and like literally like filled with like fluids and, but none of the antibiotics were working. They finally like came to me and said, okay, we still can't figure out where it is, going to do some more tests. And I remember sitting in my bed being like, okay, you for so many years worked on like your mental power and even like competing, like you're always working on like the power of the mind and like controlling your mind. And I literally sat there in bed and I wrote these affirmations for like an hour, just wrote it down, because I was really defeated by that point, like mentally really defeated. I was like kind of like giving up point. Mm. And I was like, no, Laura, like there's the only one person now that can fix this and like make it better. And it's like, it's you. Like these doctors are doing everything and nothing's helping. And I don't know if it's coincidence or like whatever, but that afternoon they came back and they were like, okay, we found where the infection's from. And I was out of hospital like 3 days later, which...
And where was it coming from?
It was, so I had like ovarian cysts, which is super common in women. Like,
yeah. I think. Sorry, I'm saying yes only because I went out with a girl that had ovarian cysts.
Yeah. And they're really common. They're not like an issue.
But how was it that they were bleeding?
So one of them got infected just from being really run down was basically what it is. And
You said earlier, and I'm
changing lifestyle.
But also, you said earlier that at a certain point you didn't have a period for like 4 years or something like that.
Yeah.
Did that have an effect?
No, they said that it wasn't really a thing. I mean, they'd always kind of like.
Did you
flared.
Worry that there was a connection between your bulimia and the fact that you hadn't had periods and then these cysts occurring?
Well, they did a lot of like, they did some checks as well, like in turn, just to like make sure like there was nothing like lasting maybe from the bulimia or like whatever. Like just, they did like a whole body like kind of scan. But yeah, no, literally one of the cysts got infected and became in the space of, so when they found it, it was 3 centimeters.
That's big.
Yeah, and then in the space, so they then started with the right antibiotic for this. They found out what it was. It's treated me for 2 days and nothing was working. You know, I was like, had them being pumped into my arm, nothing was working, wasn't like fighting it, I was getting worse. So they checked the abscess again and it had grown to 9 centimeters. So then I went into, it's like that. So it had grown like in 3 days, like... Well, pretty big.
Yeah.
And then they're like, okay, are you happy to have an operation? I was like, yeah, now. Like, I want to go like right now just to do it. And they're like, okay, well, we can either put you to sleep. I was like, honestly, I don't even need any painkillers. Like, just get this out.
Get on with it. Don't even care. Yeah.
And yeah, honestly, those guys are incredible. That night I was feeling like pretty much sweet. Well, not sweet. It took me a good 6 months to get better.
National Health looked after you pretty, pretty good.
Yeah, amazing. Really, really, really well.
No, so one of the greatest institutions in the United Kingdom, I would suggest.
Definitely.
A lot of others. So there's you. What's happening now?
Well, like I said before, trying to...
Got a YouTube channel?
Yeah, so YouTube is underway. Hopefully.
How easy is that?
It's not that easy, mate. I will tell you that
do
right
you know
now.
What? Yeah.
My organisation skills, my team manager, my mum, my manager will all tell you I am so bad.
Well, what are you so bad at? I mean, I just find it absolutely confusing, to be honest.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
But some people don't.
My life was so
simple.
People
like Jamal Edwards find it very, very easy and understandable.
Yeah.
They can deconstruct it very, very clearly.
So for me, it's like a passion project. It's mental health and fitness, two things I'm really, really passionate about. And kind of putting them together, and I'm getting other people on to chat about how fitness has implemented them in their mental health.
In positive and negative?
Yeah. I think I listen to so many things where they speak about mental health and I just think it sounds sometimes so like no light at the end of the tunnel. And I'd like to do something that just seem, you know, gives like a way out, you know, and like this is, you know, I struggle with this and this was how I got out, you know, like there's a solution rather than be like, oh, this was my story and it was really, really sad and kind of...
Because I'm going to tell you my surf story. Because when I was a kid, we used to go on holiday to Pembrokeshire, which is...
My mum's from there.
Is she?
Yeah.
It's a great little, great place. We used to go to a place called Broadhaven and Little Haven. Really good. And they had what were known, it was a bit of two-ply. You know what two-ply is? It's a bit,
yeah,
long bit
wood.
Yeah. And it curled at the end. And they called themselves, they were boogie boards before boogie boards were invented. They were actually
like just old school ones.
It's a plank of wood, yeah. Right? How on earth are you? And you literally could, if you picked the right way, I mean, you literally, you waited and it, oh God, it was freezing. There were no wetsuits and anything like that. But mate, it was just fantastic fun. And I've always wanted to surf. And so my dad spoke to a local guy who had some surfboards. And so they came along. I mean, literally with these Bismarcks, these really long boards, right? And we were in the shallows and my brother decided to stand up on it. And as he stood up on it, it went underneath him, right into the back of my head. And I still have a scar behind my
head. Oh my God, you got surf injuries?
Man,
don't worry about me.
Charlie don't surf, get Kemp surfs. and he knocked me under the water and literally knocked me out, actually. It was a good shot. I know he'd been waiting to get his own back for some time, and I swear to this day he did it on purpose. But my surf injury. But can you learn the age?
Yes, 100%.
Old farts can surf?
Yeah. It depends how much you want it.
I do want it. I just don't want to do it in, like, no disrespect. I'd go to Newquay to look at the waves.
Oh, and God, no.
Go
don't
to
do it there.
Nice hotels and, like, drink nice red wine and look out at the ocean. But I see people, I see old kids like myself going out there going, yeah, man, this is going to be easy. And you just see them drowning, you know.
I think that surfing's
not literally drowning,
egos.
But you just see them, like, sitting on the end of a board for, like, you know, watch. I'm just waiting for the right wave to come. No, mate, you haven't got a clue what you're doing. Just get off the board, go into the bar, dry off, have a pint of old farts ale, open a pack of salt vinegar crisps.
I think, though, a massive part of it
is
the floating around out there. It's just a place where it's always been safe for me. When I struggled with school, it was like, okay, I'm just going to go surf and everything will be okay. Everything just goes. I think you have so many things to think about. You're paddling, you're in the ocean, you're lying on a surfboard, you're trying to catch a wave, get the wave, stand up for it, and then get back out. Mm. Like, you don't have time to think about all the other pointless things out there.
So how many times would you stand up in an afternoon, for instance?
Depends how perfect, your perfect wave you're
waiting
for.
Yeah. But
like 15 times in an hour.
That's because you're good.
Yeah, but I mean, it depends.
But once you get it, I mean, even I can remember going back to me on the little two-ply plank. You know what? Once you got one and you went all the way to the beach, man, it's like, yeah, there's a big smile on the face.
Yeah, no,
right?
But that's the thing. Like, you can't take anything away from that feeling of, like, doing it.
No, and it's like being one with nature. Yeah. Like, it's like being your own kite, isn't it? It's like being lifted up by the wind. You know what I mean?
We did a thing actually with some, like, war veterans that had, like, is it war veterans? Is that the right word? Like,
yeah.
Been to war? Yeah. That had
PTSD?
Exactly. Yeah,
post-traumatic stress disorder. Sorry, it's an area that I know something about.
About periods.
No.
Yeah, PTSD. So they came down and we basically taught them to surf because this guy had done, like, a lot of studies on, like, how the mind works when you are surfing. And he was like, I think it can cure it. So not cure it, but basically, like, give them something else to think about.
A, it's exciting. B, it's a challenge. It's what service personnel would get.
Exactly.
They'd definitely get something out of it, I would suggest.
Yeah,
but anyone can, can't they?
Yeah, no,
if
definitely. So we took them for an hour and there was one guy who he'd obviously, like, been through, like, hell and back. And his wife was on the beach and she was like, I don't know how well this is going to go. Like, if he's in the water and he has, like, some sort of, like, attack thing, then I'm not sure. We just need to make sure that he's, like, safe and stuff. So everyone was out there, like, everybody was comfortable in the ocean enough to, like, kind of get him back in if anything had happened. And the guy literally was out there for 4 hours straight. He was like, I don't want to come in. Like, he was so happy. And his wife was, like, crying on the beach. And it definitely for us that, you know, surfing is everything anyway, but to be able to share that with somebody and change their life was so, so sick.
So there is a chance of the surf school down the line.
Oh, for sure. I love sharing my sport with other people.
And nice to live by the ocean, right?
Yeah.
If I could, I would.
Yeah, for sure. Although, for me, even living in London, I've really struggled with it in the last year. I have to go away every, like, month just for a week to surf because otherwise my brain...
You do sound like you're living a very, very nice life now. Can I just say that? I have to go away
every... Oh, no,
my
life's
incredible.
You're gonna
say, I have to go away every year.
No.
I have to go away every month.
But it's more...
Your air miles must be good.
Not even really, because I go to, like, Portugal.
Yeah, what's wrong with that? great fish, great wine.
Yeah, no, it's my favourite place. That's where I'll move back to. So,
and do you speak the language?
I understand like everything. But yeah, that was like where I grew up. So that's home.
And is that the long term future?
Yeah, for sure. That's my home. But being here is great. You know, the things I'm doing at the moment is what I dreamt of like doing a year ago. And I'm now doing the things I'm really passionate about. You know, like when I came out of Love Island, I had to kind of do all that like Love Island bit. But now I'm really, really passionate about and I care about, you know, like even like having this chat with you is like so sick and I'm like stoked to be here. But there's so many other things, you know, that I want to do that I'm in this time of my life is like the perfect time.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I can be here for you're 25 years old and you've already achieved quite a lot and you've already been on a bit of a journey already, haven't you? But that is, you know, the fantastic thing about life.
For sure. I wouldn't change a thing, like even, you know, the sepsis, the bulimia, that, you know, all the things, you know, because they came with so many like other amazing things. And I think the things that you learn
but
when
learned
you have
from
crazy
them.
Highs and crazy lows is you learn how to get through them.
But they're
know,
all like, rungs on your ladder, aren't they?
Yeah, for sure. No, I love like every single stage of it that I've had to go through. And I think, yeah, I wouldn't be the same person without it. So it's Not so bad.
Definitely not so bad. And it's lovely meeting you.
Lovely to meet you too.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Kempcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe, rate and review. You can find me on Twitter at Ross Kemp and on Instagram at Ross Kemp TV. This has been a Freshwater and the Chancer Collective production. Thanks to the team and One Fine Play. And until the next episode, goodbye.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.